share that with what we have done so far on understanding the diet-behavior connection, that you can see that the mind is greatly influenced by what we can see in the way of just ordinary things in our diet. Now, as you know, the diet can be tasty and can be sufficient to make us feel plump or look plump, and we can still not be functioning in the mind well from the diet. So we need to recognize that malnutrition is not always just undernutrition. That malnutrition is most of the time in the United States overnutrition, especially specific overnutrition of some kind. And many of us have been injured by how we have handled our diets in the past, either eating too much or eating wrong things, that make us so that we are no longer uninjured, but we become injured people because of that very thing that we have done with our diet that we may have thought was the proper thing to make us be plump and healthy and pretty. If you will turn in the book Nutrition for Vegetarians, those of you who have that, to page 105, chapter 15, the section on diabetes. And I would like to talk just a little bit about diabetes. It is a large cause of disease in the United States. And even for people who do not have frank diabetes, there are many of us with an hereditary background that makes us prone to diabetes. So if we get just a little overweight, we're very likely to come down with diabetes. Or if we have a pregnancy, we are very likely to have an overweight baby. So that is a baby weighing more than 8 pounds. So this can help us to understand the magnitude of the problem with diabetes in this country. Now, if you'll look on the first page of chapter 15, page 105, you will see the first section is on accelerated aging. Diabetes can very properly be considered accelerated aging. Now, for the individual who has diabetes, Internal Medicine News says that there is no such thing as responsible snack foods for diabetics. Well, that, since most of us have a genetic background that encourages diabetes, could we extrapolate from that and say that there is no such thing as responsible snack food? I do believe that. 3 eating experiences per day should be the limit for human beings. 3 eating experiences. Even that is one more than is ideal. 2 eating experiences per day is ideal. The ideal meal pattern, breakfast and lunch. Now, with accelerated aging, that means that we start getting carious teeth, appendicitis, tonsillitis, and we begin to lose these organs. We lose the teeth, we lose the appendix, we lose the tonsils to surgery. Dental surgery is some of the commonest surgery done in this country. It is rampant that we have carious teeth. And the reason that we have so much in the way of carious teeth has to do with our diet. Eskimos had unknown caries. They were just unknown among them prior to 1950. But when the Alcan Highway went through in 1953, a national experiment was done with the Eskimos. They went from 25 pounds of sugar per person per year in 1950 to 125 pounds of sugar per person per year in just a very short time. So it gave us an opportunity to test the diseases before and after in this group. And we have found that carious teeth never occurred prior to 1950, and women, Eskimo women, would sit around and tan leather by chewing the caribou hide. But they can no longer do that because of the fact that they have so much in the way of carious teeth. So, carious teeth represents accelerated aging. Appendicitis represents accelerated aging. Losing your tonsils represents accelerated aging. To grow up to be taller than your mother, if you're a woman, is accelerated aging. To be overweight is accelerated aging. Do you see how this works? We simply study the body. We know what kind of person is likely to get cancer and heart disease and death from some other causes. And so we just go back down and we find out what kind of individual it is that will turn out to have that kind of disease. So far as cancer is concerned, cancer of the breast, which is a very common disease in women, is far more likely to occur if the woman is taller than 5'6". Far more likely to occur if the woman weighs more than 140 pounds. Yes, a woman is far more likely to have cancer of the breast if she is taller than 5'6". Far more likely to have cancer of the breast if she weighs more than 140. So we just weigh people and measure people and count the numbers of cancers of the breast. So those of us who are above that, we can just say, wow, here is something I can't control. I'm already full grown and I'm more than 5'6". What to do? Well, study everything else. That's the only thing you can do. And be very careful on everything else. Do you see how you must handle this kind of thing? Again, this lets us see how physicians cannot put hard and fast rules on anything, because your past life may determine what your attitude should be towards something now. And only you know the history of your past life, so you are the one who should make a decision as to what should happen to your life now. For this reason, when somebody goes what one might consider off the deep end with diet, I try just to educate. I don't legislate on what they should do. Let's say they decide they should eat all raw foods. Well, I might tell them what my experience has been and how I think that they might not be able to get a fully nourishing diet, especially if they keep it up for a long time. Maybe a month might be all right, but to go on all raw foods for the next 15 years, as some people do, that to me seems extreme. So I just teach, but still let the person decide for himself what he is going to do. Our Heavenly Father does that, doesn't he? He does not make us do what he says is the ideal. He presents the ideal and then each person must make his choices. And sometimes even what God has told us is the ideal will be altered a bit by what has happened to us. To give you an example, one time I had a secretary who had had 3 major procedures on her stomach. When she first came to be my secretary, she was very enthusiastic and very loyal and wanted to do everything exactly right, and just as we did here at Uchi Pines, just to be perfect. So she went on 2 meals a day because that's what most of the families here do, and she got sick. And pretty soon she was vomiting day and night and we were giving her IV fluids because she couldn't retain anything. So I sat down with her and I said, why do you think that you had this? Oh, I don't know why I had this thing. I've really been doing everything just right. I've been eating only this and this and this, and I've been trying to get some things. Of course, certain things. I've been trying to get whole wheat bread in my diet, and I've even eaten some popcorn, and I've only eaten two meals a day. She said, I was never able to eat popcorn before, but since you've been teaching that it's such a good food, I thought that maybe I ought to try some. And two meals a day, I've been really faithful with that. She said, I never did eat less than four or five or six meals before I came here. So I said, well, you may need to eat more than the rest of us. So she started back with her five meals a day with my blessing. But now, what have I just been teaching you that you should do so far as a meal pattern is concerned? Five or six meals a day? No, the upper limit would be three eating experiences per day. But this lady, who could only take a half cup or so at a meal, if she didn't have that, then she set up some certain reflux operations in her own stomach because of the several procedures that had connected her duodenum with the stomach in bad places that made it so that she could not tolerate what the rest of us could. So to the present day, she is taking four meals a day, and that with my blessing. So you see, each person must think about who he is, what his past has been, what his current possibilities are. And from the standpoint of who he is and what his present condition is, he should make his decisions. Now, let's go back to my statement a little earlier, and that is there is no such thing as responsible snacking in diabetes. Is that correct or not correct? It is correct if you're a normal person. That is, have a normal gastrointestinal tract. But if you have had several surgeries on your stomach, then you must consider all of that on your stomach as well. Now, diabetes represents two separate diseases. One is the adult-onset type of diabetes, and the other thing is the juvenile-onset diabetes. These are now called type 1 and type 2, the juvenile being type 1, which is fairly rare. 90% or more of cases of diabetes are the adult-onset type. On page 106, you will see a section on the Pima Indians and the Yemenite Jews, as well as the Eskimos. All three of these, on a very natural diet, which they had been accustomed to for generations, they had no diabetes. The Yemenite Jews moved to Israel, and there they took a Western-type diet, and suddenly they started having lots of diabetes. Eskimos, the same thing. They have as much diabetes now as we have on the mainland. Juvenile diabetes is an altogether different thing from the adult-onset type. The adult-onset type is related to the diet, related to the weight. 80% of overweight adults will get diabetes. But juvenile diabetes is non-hereditary. It has nothing to do with your family background. It has to do with the kinds of infectious diseases that you have had. And there are several kinds of infectious diseases that if you have these, many of these are childhood diseases like mumps. And mumps, we know, can go down to the genitals. Most people are aware that mumps can do what is called going down in the testes, which is an orchitis caused by the mumps virus. Well, this same mumps virus can involve not only the testes, but also the ovaries and also the pancreas. So it can involve any of our glandular structures, salivary glands, pancreas, or gonads. So those who have had these kinds of diseases may have had their islet cells injured or even destroyed by the infection. If they should have, then they will have a permanent form of diabetes, which cannot be treated as you can treat adult-onset diabetes by fasting and by diet. you should not fast a person who has juvenile diabetes. To fast a person with juvenile diabetes will often throw them into an acidosis, which will result in their having to be hospitalized and given IV fluids and worked with diligently to prevent their dying. So you do need to be careful with a juvenile diabetic, the insulin-dependent diabetic. Now, on page 109, you will see a section on hypoglycemia. If you study the book Counsels on Diet and Foods, you will see that the two-meal-a-day plan and the occasional fast and the simple meal pattern, high in complex carbohydrates, is the specific program prescribed for the syndrome of symptoms, which we now call the hypoglycemic syndrome. Fatigue, excessive hunger, thinking that you just must eat in between meals, and feeling faint if you don't, and becoming accustomed to 7 or 8 meals a day and just feeling that you must have them, especially a midnight snack or a snack just before going to bed. This syndrome is the syndrome that we now call the hypoglycemic syndrome. Now, what was the treatment for that? 2 meals a day, nothing in between meals, and a high carbohydrate diet. But notice that it is a complex carbohydrate diet. Whole wheat bread, whole grain rice, leaving off the white products like white sugar, white starch, white flour, white spaghetti, and white rice. Now, if a person has this kind of diet, he can couple with that regularity, exercise, sunshine, and fresh air, and these should go a long way toward recovery from the hypoglycemic syndrome. Now, some of you are aware that we have taught, Seventh-day Adventists have taught for a long time that there are some foods that some people cannot take. They disagree with them. There are some vegetables that some people cannot take, some fruits that some people cannot take. If you cannot tolerate those, you should simply leave them off. If you leave them off for a whole year, you can then test them again and see if you can tolerate them now. Sometimes after a year of abstinence from a food, if you've had total abstinence, the body will heal from its sensitivity to a food. The hypoglycemic syndrome is sometimes associated with food sensitivities. So if you can remember to work on that, it can be a great help to you. Now, in your book, Home Remedies, if you will turn to page 119, you will see a section on mental illness. I would like to talk with you a bit about how to treat mental illness. Forms of hydrotherapy useful in treating the mentally ill include the sedative pack, which is a full body pack, a neutral bath or whirlpool, the warm fomentation, a wet sheet pack. These can all be nicely used. Now, if you want to obtain a stimulating effect, such as you might desire for someone who has a lethargic type of mental illness or depression, then you could use graduated cold packs, beginning mild and gradually getting colder. These need not be torture. In fact, my personal opinion is that if a treatment is torture, it probably will not do you as much good as if it is given in a milder form. Same treatment, but in a milder form. Some people are extremely sensitive to chilling, and if you give them a cold shower or a cold bath, you may do them a good bit of harm. I remember the patient that we had with malaria. We've only had one patient who has that we have treated with malaria here. So we recommended a cold bath for this individual. That has been recommended in the past for malaria. So we thought we would try the cold bath. Well, this person just didn't think that the cold bath would sit with the kind of physiology that he had at all. He thought that he would simply die with a cold bath. But he was put in the cold bath anyway. He was assisted in under protest, but he was not actually lifted in, but he was encouraged a little more than I thought later in hearing about the process than was entirely proper, and that he would, and I was not surprised that he didn't appear to get any benefit from the cold bath. So we only tried it once for him. But I think if the cold bath had been warmed up a little bit and perhaps 3 or 4 days used and getting him accustomed to it, that this might have been helpful. By the way, in using the cold bath, if you will wet the head with cold water first and splash cold water over the face, this can be very helpful. And plunge in. Don't just stick a toe in first. Just jump in. And that can be helpful in tolerating it. Now, the first column, page 119, I would like to read the experience that a hospital in Illinois had before the era of tranquilizers in treating their mentally ill patients over a 9-year period with hydrotherapy. Now, mental illness, as you know, used to be really defeating. Once a person was sent to the hospital, you just sort of said goodbye forever to them. And they were just kept in mental institutions for the rest of their lives. Now, in this kind of climate, in Illinois, they started using hydrotherapy. They were constantly developing and extending their hydrotherapy during that length of time. And they experienced an increasing improvement rate with more hospital discharges. During the first 3-year period, the percentage of patients paroled and discharged was 38.2%. During the second 3-year period, there were 44.63%. During the third 3-year period, 67.83%. Patients treated with hydrotherapy were found to be more comfortable, less in conflict with others, and less in restraints. Now, we have used hydrotherapy a good bit with good success in treating the mentally ill. Treatment of psychotic patients can be either localized or general with heat, and we have found good results with such things as hot foot baths, total hot baths, or long-term wet sheet packs. But notice that it is important for you to keep cold to the head of these individuals. The reason for that is that the blood flow to the head can increase, and with the suppression of nerve impulses across certain synapses or junctions between two nerves that occurs with increasing heat, these individuals may lose their restraints on their control mechanisms of the body and become more and more agitated as they get more and more heated up. The head gets more and more heated. So if you give a heating treatment for a psychotic patient, remember to keep cold to the head. Keep sponging the face and keeping cold to the head. I remember a patient we had here one time who was very uncooperative. She became very unpleasant. Her husband had accompanied her here. She was abusive to her husband. She was abusive to me. She took a great dislike to me. It was almost dislike at first sight and intensified a good bit after a couple of days. So when she was at the height of her agitation, I asked her if she would let us put her in a wet sheet pack. And she said yes, but I don't mind at all taking the treatment, but I'm not going to get into it. So we were perplexed a little bit as to what she meant, and she became more and more cooperative by the moment. So we decided that three of us ladies would put her in a wet sheet pack. So she would not lie down into the pack, so we did it standing up. We wet the sheet in cold water. Now, it doesn't stay cold long, and it is not torture. The cold only lasts for a few seconds, actually, and they warm the sheet up very well. But the cold is essential at the beginning. It makes the treatment a much better one. So you use just ordinary tap water. So wrap that around the person, starting with the hands up like this. Wrap it around the trunk with the hands up, then put the hands down by the side. And the second time it is wrapped around on the outside of the arms and brought snug up around the neck. Then we assisted her to sidle over to the bed and to fall down onto the bed. And I sat beside her head and kept her head cool for about 3 hours. And she didn't sleep. Eyes would look around. I had hoped that she might sleep, but she just stayed there in her pack. She didn't struggle. Sometimes a patient will struggle, and sometimes you need more than one person to help you with the patient. They may struggle for 30 minutes or more, but she never struggled at all. But she was still looking uncooperative from her face, looking all around and just not looking very pleasant at all. From time to time, I would sing just a stanza of some hymn, but I just sat beside her bed. Occasionally, I would read a paragraph from a religious book, but I was not keeping up a chatter all the time, just maybe once every 15 or 20 minutes, just so that she would know I was still there and that I was doing what I could for her, that my attention was on her. After about 2.5 hours, I noticed that she was weeping silently. I was as I would sponge her face with the cold water, I could see that she was weeping. And in a little bit, she sobbed just a little bit, softly. And then she apologized, said she knew that she had been uncooperative and difficult to deal with. And she was sorry for that, and that was not proper. And she was determined not to do that anymore. So I said, well, fine, would you like to take a walk? She said, yes, I would. So I took her out of the pack, gave her a brief cold mitten friction. She dressed, and she followed, and I didn't put her ahead of me. I went ahead of her and let her follow me. And we took about a 4-mile walk. When we got back, she was tired and was nearly bedtime, about 8 o'clock. So I told her I thought she ought to go to bed. She went to bed. Next morning, she was an entirely different person. I asked her if she would take a sheet pack again. Again, she took another sheet pack. As cooperative as she could be, from that moment on, she was entirely cooperative, never gave us any more trouble. She became a helper for the other patients. We gave her a wet sheet pack for about an hour every day after that, and it was a marvelous treatment for her. Now, you can do a continuous neutral bath, and you see this mentioned in the first column here. Dr. Henry Kefauver reports a case of manic depressive psychosis who was being treated with a continuous neutral bath for 6 hours at 90 to 96 degrees beginning at 8 a.m. Now, this case illustrates the importance of keeping the head cool. At 8 a.m., the pulse was 104, and he was restless and talkative and uncooperative and unmanageable. But when they got him into the bath, he was strapped down for a bit, and a cold compress was applied to the forehead. In 1 hour, the pulse rate had dropped to 84. But then, by 10:30, that was an hour and a half later, the patient became very excited, noisy, and unmanageable, just as he had been before he was put through. And he broke through the canvas cover of the tub and refused any further treatment. At that time, the patient was immediately placed in a cold, wet sheet pack. On investigation, it was learned that the cold compress to the head had been removed when the pulse dropped to 80. The water temperature had been increased, making it then a hot bath, raising the body temperature, and the pulse made a corresponding rise to 124. After the cold, wet sheet pack was applied, the patient received cold to the head again, and the pulse again dropped to 80. At that time, the patient slept nearly an hour in the pack and was removed quiet and cooperative with a pulse rate around 76. Now, a number of reports in the medical literature of a cool bath being very beneficial and cold to the head, very beneficial for those who have uncooperative mental illness. You should remember the cold bath and the wet sheet pack as a very good treatment for those who are mentally ill. Any questions about mental illness or mental disease? Question.
I have a case where I have a managed depression and diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Very much overweight, 300
mm-hmm.
or something like that. Mm-hmm. This would not be advisable. Would it be
counterindicated? Question is, in a 300-pounder who is manic depressive, would a wet sheet pack be advisable? And I would say yes. I would try a wet sheet pack for her. Diabetic also, the diabetes would not be a contraindication for a wet sheet pack. Question.
Medication causes a dry mouth.
Yes.
Starting to gum.
Yes.
And I know the gum is never acceptable at any time.
Yes.
What could be done about that?
Okay. For a person who is on medication that brings about a drying of the mouth and chews gum to combat the dryness of the mouth. What should be one's attitude toward that? I don't know. Let's just discuss reasons why gum chewing is not good. One has to do with the teeth. One has to do with the fact that some chewing is strengthening to the eyes, but a lot of chewing is weakening to the eyes. And chewing also depletes the good quality of saliva, making it so that we don't digest so well. Chewing gum encourages the swallowing of air, which encourages a discomfort in the gastrointestinal tract and gas in the gastrointestinal tract and hunger, which then promotes eating between meals and a number of other things. So these are some ill effects from chewing. One must weigh these ill effects with the beneficial effect hoping to be gained. And if the person is literally miserable from the dry mouth, I think that I would try to get the very best quality gum possible. And once the sugar has been chewed from it, let them park the gum and put the same gum back in, or perhaps use something like paraffin or beeswax, which would get rid of the artificial flavors and artificial colors and the like. And I do believe that there are substances, chemical substances in chewing gum, just the common varieties, not those that would be the uncommon, readily acceptable junk food types like bubble gum and this kind, but just the readily acceptable kinds or common kinds like Wrigley's Spearmint, that these have chemicals in them of which we are but dimly aware, if aware at all, that do have a deleterious effect on the body. I think it'd be better for us just not to have any of these substances associated with the body as a normal thing. But these things should be weighed.
What about drinking water?
Drinking water is a great help even for the dry mouth that comes from taking medication. But the dry mouth that comes from taking medication can just, or the salivary glands can be paralyzed by taking medication. Question here.
Oh, I just wanted to give testimony. I'm a nurse, and I've worked with patients that are anywhere from anxious to overtly psychotic. And I didn't know anything about applying cold to the head, but I found that applying a cold washcloth, as cold as I could get it in a sink, always helped.
Mm-hmm.
It always calmed them down and always made them sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now you've told me the rationale.
Yes. Well, these hydrotherapeutic measures can be of great help to us. Yes.
Had a stroke.
Uh huh.
And then the mental illness.
Later they have a stroke and later they have a mental illness.
Yes.
These individuals can also be greatly helped by giving them hydrotherapy. It's a very good remedy for them. Okay. Other question. Yes.
How do you feel about laughing a child or adult?
All right. Okay. Question is, what about using some sort of corporal infliction like slapping or the use of a little switch or something like that for either a child or an adult? I am categorically opposed. That is for a person who is not a member of the family to do such a thing. I think that I would probably take the same attitude toward a husband doing that to a wife. I would not be so opposed to a wife maybe slapping a husband. But for me to do it to anyone, I would not be acceptable to me personally. So I would take a position of no. I do not believe in. I think that a parent can inflict a switching or a spanking for a child. That is biblical. But
I'm talking about kids as well.
In mental illness?
Yeah.
No. Not in mental illness even. I would use some other method. I would use heat or cold or walking or massage or something else. I do not feel that it's to me unacceptable to use any kind of thing that is associated with punishment.
It's also associated with hostility.
And associated with hostility.
Yes. Physical contact might be appropriate, but
yes. I think this is one of the reasons why I would not be able to accept a husband hitting a wife, because of the fact that a woman might be far more sensitive to that than a husband would. The hostility involved, or the symbol of hostility.
At question. What age did you recommend that children should not receive spankings?
All right. Question is, at what age would I recommend that children not receive spankings or switchings for misbehavior? And I don't know that I have a definite level, probably sometime in the teenage years. And parents should recognize that the infliction of a spanking or a switching is a defeat, does represent a failure of your instruction. Now, if you have had a failure in your instruction, you should recognize that and recognize that you may have to inflict punishment of a switching or spanking nature. But nevertheless, that should be a time of re-examination of your own child-rearing methods. Why is it that I am having to spank my child? there's something wrong with the way that the child is being handled that makes frequent spankings or a spanking at all necessary.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.